This concludes our broadcast day. Good night, and God bless America.
I don't have like any experience in it or anything. I just became, have you ever heard of Plays in Verse? They're a publishing house.
I think I have heard of that.
They're really super, super cool. Like they do really amazing work. And I found out about them however many years ago. AWP was in Tampa, I think somewhere in Florida, wherever we were. Mm-hmm. And I went to Whale Prom and they were in the back and I picked up a few of their books. And one of the books I picked up was Dalton Day's Exit Pursued, which is a bunch of these little, I think they're mainly monologues, but they're so smart and they like really make you think, and they're super bizarre and not what I'm used to. And I don't know about your experience in school, but not the type of plays that I was being taught. So I was like, this is amazing. I've got to write a play and try something like this. And so yeah, I set to work. Obviously it took several years to do after that, but it was, I was interested in nonverbal autistic people and how you could make someone who's nonverbal the heart of a story, especially a story that relies totally on dialogue, obviously. So I don't think I succeeded very well because most of the characters in Kinder Kranken House can speak, but I tried to incorporate a lot of autistic stereotypes, I guess. So like there's someone who's echolalic, so like a part, and just how we think of that communication as being like glossolalia, like kind of gibberish and stuff like that, but really it's a form of communicating even though it's echoing back to you. So there's that. There's a character who says things to people, but they're using words that like homonyms basically, and homophones. So if you're saying, trying to think of an example there, but for what the only one I can think of is justice. So if someone, one of the doctors talking about justice and the idea of justice, and the character says back to him, just us. So you think they're just repeating, you think they're just kind of talking gibberish, but really they're adding another whole layer of meaning into it. Okay, so I'm rambling a little bit, but basically, to answer your question, it was super cool. Like, it's not, several people are like, is it amazing? Is it just like what you thought it would look like? I'm like, no, it doesn't look anything like I thought it would look like in my head, but it's so cool to see someone else's interpretation, and not just one person's, the director's, but all of the actors and their interpretation of the characters, and how, you know, you say, writers say things in their head over and over and over again, and you say it a certain way when you're writing something and rereading that passage, and to hear someone totally take it and be like, oh, I read it as this, is so freaking cool. And like, it blows your mind in a way, because you're like, wow, it's so, again, like the point of the play is just about how language is so bizarre, and how are any of us communicating basically, because it's so hard. And then to have someone take a line and totally reinterpret it into something you not was weren't necessarily intending or hadn't even thought of is so cool, and adds a completely different dimension to it, you know? So
yeah,
Laser, I don't know so too much about them. I've been trying to do more research, but it was an incredible experience. I encourage every writer to write a play. Also, it's like, I don't know if the theater world's just more welcoming or something, but I've never gotten so many compliments and like attention to a piece of writing in my entire life. And that's like a, I can have a 3-line poem that I'm like, please read this, please read this. There's something about people are like, seem more willing to say, oh, I'll watch it. I'll watch something rather than read it, I guess. Not readers, obviously, but anyway.
I had a conversation in college with a friend who's a screenwriter that I've always remembered, where he had been in a class with people who were working on fiction, like creative writing in that form.
Yeah.
And he just said to me, you guys are so mean.
Right. You know,
and I always thought about that probably, you know, different mediums that people are working in, there's probably like different expectations, or I don't know exactly what it is, but it's funny you say that, because I've just kind of, ever since he said that, I've noticed that about you know, screenwriting and people who write plays, that there seems to be like more of a generosity maybe with that format. I don't know, not that, you know, fiction and that community can't be generous as well, but I just, it seems like maybe because it's a different medium, and like you said, people are watching something, there's a different way they approach it.
It's a different culture in a way, you know, like I 100% agree. I also think too, if you think of actors and directors, like their challenge is to take a piece and bring it to life no matter what. So they're not necessarily looking to rearrange the dialogue or anything. They're looking to see, how can I most successfully execute this? So their enthusiasm, it's very bizarre for a fiction writer. You're like, do you really? It's so weird, you know, like when you're getting compliments, it's like, great. I hope so. But yeah, so it was cool to see like that process too, how they attack their art, you know. It's a different culture, I guess. Yeah.
The subject matter that you were writing about in the play, how did you first get interested in telling a story about this?
Sure. So I feel like all of my writing is about language. I'm really into like etymology and stuff, and how like roots of words and how they twist and turn to become what we use them today and stuff, and how language is still obviously growing and changing, like with pronoun usage and everything like that. I was writing and did write a novel set in Germany right after World War II. So right between when the war ended and the wall went up. Hopefully that book will get published one day. And then, so I was doing a lot of research about Germans, and I found stuff about their hospitals, their Kinder Krankenhauses and stuff, and where they used to send people, German people that they deemed not sufficient to be good Nazis, and euthanized them and stuff. And it was just surprising to me. I'm part German, part Irish, and it's something I had never really heard of. I mean, you hear, and not that it should, you know, garner more attention than any other plights that were going on at that time, but it was just so bizarre to me, because you think of these groups and being like super protective of their own, and they really weren't. They like had a weeding system for their own children, basically, and it was I thought that was incredibly interesting and like a different history. So this play is based on that. It's not really set in a specific time or location, but obviously there's a lot of allusion to Nazis and Germany and everything, even in the title. And then I think I just have been doing a lot of research about autism, and I think it's really incredibly interesting how rapidly our understanding of autistic people have changed lately. And again, it ties to me, autism is a really a study of language and how people communicate. And I think we use verbal communication as like the standard for, you know, whether or not someone's intelligent, whether or not someone you know, is good enough for X, Y, or Z, got college and school and all that type of stuff. And it's really problematic, obviously, for autistic people who are can be very super bright or just regular people, and they have this difficulty with communication in whatever capacity, and it can be relatively minor to people being nonverbal as well. So I just tied all of these together. They all seem interrelated to me. I mean, they are interrelated. A lot of the people that were euthanized by the Nazis were autistic or had Down syndrome or fetal alcohol syndrome, just a whole bunch of different things that impacted their ability to communicate. I don't know if that's a satisfactory answer, but that's how it came to be.
That's a great answer. I mean, I think it's really cool that you're writing about it, and I think it's a really important subject. I think I mentioned in my email, my wife has taught special needs students for a couple of years, and what you're saying about the difference in the way that people with autism communicate is something she's told me a lot about, and that I just had no awareness of before she was in that role. But you know, like she'll tell me all the time about how, like, as a special needs teacher, that's something that she has a lot of frustration with, you know, is that some of her students, she sees how incredible they are, and she'll tell me things that they say and things that she learns from them, and she's just like constantly, you know, delighted by how great it is to be around them and to learn about the way that their brains work. And then she'll have to talk to, you know, people in other parts of the school that have to deal with them, and they just don't have any awareness of the fact that this is just a different way that this person communicates, and they can be kind of cruel about it. And so she's always trying to have to explain, like, well, actually that's just a different way that they're trying to talk with you. And like,
right.
Do you feel like your play has, maybe for the people who've seen it, generated a little bit of awareness for some of that stuff or some conversation around it?
So I definitely think so. For this first iteration, it was at a university. I worked closely with different classes that were studying, you know, one was an inclusion class, so inclusion through the arts. And so we had students, we had the majority of the main roles, like the vast majority of the main roles in this play, went to autistic actors, which was kind of incredible because I live in a super rural area, and there's not a lot of actors in general to begin with. So we put out the call, and it was amazing. And I think it's interesting because people didn't know how to respond to it. There were two performances. One night they like started off laughing, and then it got really, really quiet because it was like, oh, this is not like this isn't My Fair Lady type thing. You know what I mean? And like, but I do think people were amazed at the actors and how incredible they were and what nuance they brought to it. And a lot of them were kids, like 13, 15 years old, even 20, like they were young. And I have a hard time memorizing anything, and these lines are not, it's abstract, right? So a lot of it's like kind of, it's not easy. Like, first she tells about the day, then she goes and, you know, accuses John of something. Like, there's not a linear progression. It's like all these random thoughts and difficult words. And anyway, they did an amazing job, and I think it was great for the audience to see what a great job they could do. Even people that are close to these actors were, you know, concerned and about just, you know, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of hours to put into. Anyone's tired after all of that type of stuff. And they were amazing. They did an incredible, incredible job. And I think the audience took things away. I know the classes that worked with us definitely did. So it was great all around. It was super cool. And I like what you said too about your wife and the communication. I think too, we don't give people, in general, people don't give other people a chance. And that could be someone who's autistic trying to get some words out. It could also be someone who doesn't speak English. Like, we don't give people, you'll notice, I notice now when I'm talking to people, people give each other about 3 seconds. And if you don't respond, they're trying to fill in, they're trying to help you say something, trying to steer the conversation, or they just give up and they're like, oh, okay, and kind of walk away type of thing. We don't leave any room for things that aren't immediately reciprocated or reciprocal, I guess. Anyway.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. Several members of my family are fluent in Spanish because I'm half Mexican American, and I've been learning Spanish the last couple of years very, very slowly. But I work with a few people who, I don't see them all the time, but I see one woman in particular. I only see her once a week, and she only speaks Spanish. And so, you know, like at the beginning, when I first started to have interactions with her, I would just be super self-conscious and worried about, you know, like I was worried that if I tried to use the little bit of Spanish that I knew to communicate with her, that would be offensive or maybe like annoying, or I don't know really what I thought. Sure, but
I get it. Yeah.
So I would kind of just ask someone else to communicate through us. But then I was talking with a woman who English was her second language, and she told me, you know, nobody ever really tries to extend like some effort to me. Like before I learned how to speak English, she was saying, like, you know, people kind of just expect me to do all the work. And it's so wonderful when people try to speak Spanish to me. And so after she said that, I started trying to communicate with my coworker just between the two of us and not use a third person. And sometimes it is, you know, a little awkward. We don't understand what the other person is saying, but I've noticed that there's actually this like really wonderful thing that happens where we're kind of like enjoying trying to communicate, and I can tell that she appreciates the effort. And I think that's, I hadn't thought about how that could extend to people with autism or people who communicate non-verbally, but that makes sense to me that, like, you know, people, yeah, probably do get frustrated, and if it's not happening right away, kind of maybe give up. But I don't know.
Make a ton of assumptions about that person.
Definitely. Right.
And I always think, especially people who speak multiple languages, you're like, I love languages. I've studied German and French and Spanish, but I am way better reading than spoken. Like, I am horribly embarrassed when I have to do speaking. Yeah. And so, you know, but the thing that you see with people, and maybe this is just like the people I live around and stuff and where I'm from, but I think people okay, you know, like there's assumptions about how smart that person is or et cetera. And you're like, the fact that they can even moderately speak another language makes them super bright. Sorry. Like, it's incredibly difficult. I mean, at least for me, it's incredibly difficult to do. So it's like, if people are even moderately bilingual, like that's an incredible. And it just speaks again to our, again, verbal assumptions based on your verbal ability, a lot of things about you, and you're not even giving the person an opportunity to exchange that, you know? So.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because you said that, you know, when you're writing the play, you're trying to like combine all these ideas. And to me, this, like, I've never thought about how these things connect, but I think you did a successful job at it, because I'm realizing ways in which these things are related that I've never thought about before, even just talking about it.
Yeah. It was really cool. I the chorus speaks from Derrida's Cinders. I don't know if you've ever read it, but it's basically, it's like, to me, I don't know, I'm not an expert or anything in continental philosophy or any of that stuff, but I do like reading it and thinking about things. And to me, it really is like a poetic way of talking about deconstruction. And so he just compares it to, you know, flames and burning out, and what you have, words are what you have left behind, which are the cinders. So it's really just a remnant of the real meaning and stuff like that. So I like that in my writing, just kind of weaving different influences in together and like allusions to different things. I think I just have always liked that even as a kid and stuff. So
I was going to ask you about that. I read your story that's in Volume 1, Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I have it right here. Just want to get the title correctly. The Parallel of Water and Air.
Yep.
And I also read a few of your poems. And what I was wondering about when I was reading it was like how much research you do. And also just about like your background as far as like what you like to read and what you've read, because I noticed that there were a lot of allusions and, you know, some interesting like historical ideas that I was just wondering how you incorporate those things, like, you know, like as you're working, if it's something that you like come across when you're reading and you think that's a cool concept and I want to work with it, or if it's things that you already kind of have in the background. So what kind of stuff do you like to read, and like what have you kind of read historically?
Yeah, so my favorite author, as a kid, I can remember literally the day my grandma taking me to the public library and finding Vonnegut, and I read Cat's Cradle, and I'm obsessed with Vonnegut. As an adult, I have everything ever written about him by him. So that's been a lifelong love. I love, we write very differently, but I love how he takes huge concepts and writes them very simply. Like that, I think, is what I love about him. But as an adult and growing up and stuff, I like, this is so nerdy. I like history, and I like, so I do a lot of my writing's like based in some historical facts. So like the Parallel of Water and Air is based on Napoleon, and there was quite a bit of research even for a short story about Napoleon's life and trajectory. And this is a real kind of myth. And I found out about it. I rescue a lot of books from like old barns up here, and then like library book sales, and there's this weird little compendium. They say Rod Sterling put it together, but it's like weird stories and stuff like that from whatever the 50s, and that was one of the myths in there. And then I looked it up, and there is this whole big myth about all these different doppelgangers for Napoleon, and I just thought it was so bizarre, and thought it was cool. So authors that I love that do that kind of stuff, that like, and so I guess the answer is historical fiction, but I like weird historical fiction. And so like Thalia Field is one of my favorite authors. She wrote quite a few books, but one of the ones that I love the most is called Experimental Animals. And it's about Bernard? It's a real historical figure who did a lot of vivisection in France right during the revolution and stuff like that, or maybe post-revolution. And so it imagines basically his life through the lens of his wife, who doesn't like the fact that he's chopping up all these dogs and looking at their beating organs while they're still alive and stuff like that. So anyway, she's amazing. She's incredible. And she does a lot of that type of stuff where it's like historical, but kind of reimagined. And then like my other favorite people are like Carol, I'm going to just pronounce it how I say it in my head, because I don't know if it's correct, but Carol Masso or Maso, M-A-S-O. Defiance is like my favorite book ever written. And it's just, again, just, she writes just kind of, it's like lyrical prose, I guess. It becomes poetry, even though it's a novel type of thing. I just like language and how, and using language in different ways than we're used to, basically. Which is what I try to do with Kern Punk too, often. It's less concerned necessarily with plot. I'm way more concerned with like language and how people present language, basically. If that is not too broad a thing to say.
No, that actually makes a lot of sense, because I was looking at some of the titles and it seems like you have a pretty diverse group of authors.
Yeah.
So I was curious about how you selected them. I interviewed Jason Teal about his book on another episode, and that book was interesting to read in all the ways that it played with language and identity and names and things like that. Do you remember what some of your introductory work was that you read as far as getting into more experimental literature?
This is a good question. I can remember. So I remember very distinctly in seventh grade reading The Great Gatsby and being like, oh my God, those eyeballs are God. And like, it like blew my mind. And I know people like hate on The Great Gatsby, but I love it for that reason.
I did that too.
Yeah.
It like blew my
mind. Yeah. And then I remember like later in high school reading Toni Morrison, Beloved. And I'd be interested to go back to it now, because I just remember at the time, I'm like, oh my God, look at how she's constructing sentences. And like, it was just so different. And I can't remember if she was just kind of imitating like colloquial, like how people speak, or if it really was like more experimental. But I remember at the time thinking, this is so crazy and great. And and then I'm trying to think, like a lot of it comes from poetry, I think, too, like getting introduced to different poets. And like, it doesn't have to be necessarily anyone contemporary, but like Baudelaire, and I love things in translation. I think it's like I think of Lolita and stuff, reading that in college and stuff. But people whose language isn't their first language isn't English, and how they describe things often is like, oh my God, that's so magical that they tied these two things together that you'd never think of. Those are the ones that come to mind that I remember sitting there and being like, this is so crazy in the best way type of thing.
I kind of have this memory of being, I don't know, maybe like 22 or something, and working on a story that I was realizing, like as I was writing it, I was just having so much fun working on it. But also realizing at the same time that it wasn't really like a conventional piece of fiction that maybe would be appreciated by like, you know, a mass audience. Like maybe it would be appreciated by like a smaller group of people, but I liked doing it so much that I didn't really care. And I'm always just interested to hear if you remember like a moment like that, that you realized that your style was something that was maybe a little bit different, maybe a little experimental, but you were having so much fun with it that that was the most important thing, and you wanted to keep, you know, working in that style.
Yeah, I think so. I think, again, that a lot of that started like in college is when I started publishing my poetry, and I think poetry was really a way into experimenting with prose more. I'm trying to think of like, I wrote one about, I've always been, and I still am, somewhat maudlin and dramatic. So like, I look back on that writing, you know, and it goes like, I never was like a, you know, Cormac McCarthy, you know, like someone who has like these sentences, like my sentences always went on and on and on. And you're like, all right, this is getting ridiculous. Like we have to do. So I think there was always that kind of tending towards flowery language, but I do think that poetry probably was the way that I got into experimenting with my prose more, because poetry just seems like such a free space that's like, to me, is dictated by like beat and flow and alliteration and like how the words blend together, like the musicality, I guess.
So poetry was where you started and then kind of experimented with prose as you were working?
Yeah. I definitely started with poetry, and then I'd been working on my first novel that got published, The Book of the Last Word from Whiskey Tit. I worked on that all throughout college and went through several iterations, and I mean, for a long time. And I think too, you can see like a young person wrote that when you read it now, but I do think like getting into that prose and thinking about how to still tell a story with all the experimentation and with the language took a much longer to do in prose form, I guess.
Totally.
Yeah.
Your story that I read was so interesting because the first time I read it, I was getting these names of historical people and I decided that on the first read through that I was just gonna enjoy the language because you were doing such interesting things with, the different words that all sound the same with each section. And I'll link to this story in the episode description because I want people to go read it. But I decided I was just gonna appreciate the language on the first go through. And then the second time I looked up the main character that appears, and I don't wanna mispronounce the name, so I won't try, but I didn't know this myth that you mentioned about how, Napoleon may have had these doppelgangers filling different places. And the idea was just so interesting about what is a self, what is a, mm-hmm. a person? If a person is malleable, all these questions are what I was kind of thinking about as I read it. And I was just wondering I never want to ask somebody what was the story about for you, but what was it that you were kind of thinking about as you played with this idea of Napoleon and these doppelgangers?
So first, I just want to say it's totally cool that you're not going to pronounce that name because I couldn't pronounce that.
Oh, right on.
I just wrote it down and in my head, I do my French, which is probably disgusting to a French person. But to me, what I thought was interesting, again, take all the words that you hear and it sounds like the same word, and how they change and everything, to me mirrors how the main character basically subsumes Napoleon Napoleon's identity and changes to rectify some wrong he did in the past. And I just like the idea of the fact that our personhood is rooted in how we're labeling ourselves, so we can change our labels at any point basically and become basically a whole different person, which is kind of comforting. And when you think of all the stupid things you've done or said and you're well, I'm no longer that person. And so I think that's the base for me, was just thinking about how we label ourselves and how we can change it at any time, and how long a crime or a bad deed follows us if we decide to reject that label, I guess.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, because you always hear people say things well, I was a different person then and things like that. But that kind of reveals something, even that phrase, that, yeah, people can change. And over time, maybe you do become something that's totally different from what you were before.
Right.
I'm always kind of fascinated with that idea, just that who we are may not be as solid as we think it is, or
right.
What actually are we? Are we I don't know. I've kind of wrestled with this a lot. Are we, does a self even exist, or mm-hmm. is it so malleable that, maybe it's not as definable as we like to pretend? But then at the same time, I always feel like going too far in that direction can be kind of destabilizing for me almost. I have to kind
for
of.
Sure.
hold on to the idea that there's something there that is solid. Does that make sense?
100%. I think one of the interesting things is when you do think, so I'm 37, almost 40, but when I think about being 20 and you're all the things I was doing, and you're just Jesus Christ. And I do feel a completely different person, but that butts up against the idea that you do carry part of yourself throughout your entire life across time. You know, you do carry your memories, and even if the way you're thinking is different and your actions or your body's completely different, you still carry parts of yourself from the past with you. So there's like that tension that's, it's interesting, I think, when you think about crime too, when you get these people who get like gigantic sentences, whatever, 20, 30 years. And I'm not saying one way or another if people deserve this or not, but I'm just saying, like, what a weird thing if our self is so changeable and changes through time, or a lot of people's selves are, maybe not everyone's, I don't know. But anyway, there's a tension there for sure. I completely agree. The thought that there's nothing stable would be very scattering you to the wind, I think, too, mentally. So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I used to believe that pretty wholeheartedly, you know, that like we're too able to change, and like it doesn't make sense to think of yourself as like a self, I guess. You know, kind of very, like, I guess a very Buddhist idea, which I still find a lot of value in and think is really interesting. But I also noticed, like, at least just for myself, like at the same time, like when I tried to just, when I really sincerely tried to just believe that, it just felt kind of like unmanageable, because then I would run into all these questions about like, well, if I'm not really a self, then why do anything? Like, why do I, you know?
Absolutely. The nihilism creeps in for right, sure. Right. 100%. Exactly. And I, it's, for me, it's like, it can be very like, yeah, I try not to go too far that way, because you're like, then there's no point to doing any of this. So yeah. I 100% agree. I think it's a really interesting struggle, and like, I don't have a good answer for it, but I think it's really interesting to think about. I'm on the same page.
So another thing I was kind of curious about was just where your love of literature and language came from, like how that kind of started, because, you know, even just through doing something like this podcast, I've noticed that you have to really have a lot of love for something to kind of keep doing it. And I guess it's the same with like having a writing practice, like wanting to keep writing things, wanting to keep publishing in a space where there's not a lot of, you know, it's not like other things that you can do. It's not like, you know, woodworking where you can get better over time and then look, one day, you know, I've built this beautiful sculpture. It's sometimes it feels more like something that you're kind of doing in obscurity and just for the love of it. And I've just been thinking a lot about that lately, that people within the writing world, and especially like the indie lit experimental writing world, so often just have so much compassion for what they're doing, because, you know, they're giving places to publish to people that might not otherwise have them, and they're you know, you're doing things like Small Fair, which we can talk about, and it just, I can sense it, like when I look at the body of work that you're you know, creating, and like things that you're participating in, that there's clearly like a strong love of everything that you're doing. So yeah, I just was curious about where that comes from.
I even as a like a little kid, I was super like big into reading. Like, I have all my little reading awards in class and stuff like that. I think part of it comes from, you know, being a weird kid, I guess. Like, not that I didn't have friends and stuff, but I was always like the weirdo, always getting picked on type of stuff. And there's something very quiet and meditative about reading that you don't necessarily experience with other art forms. I just always have thought art was incredibly important, more than like it, pretty much anything in the world. I think art is one of the most important things we can do. And I think this is the art form that I felt I could do the best in. And I think it definitely does feel like a mission, like you're saying. Like, it feels like a like if you don't provide this space, we're going to be losing things like that, that there's an urgency there, because a lot of way people are taught and a lot of how people get published is by following a commercial set guideline, which we all know about, but there's nothing wrong with it necessarily. There's nothing wrong with entertainment, but I'm more interested in the art space of literature. And I think that is something that can potentially be neglected. And I'm trying to think like what made me love books. When I was really little, my parents got divorced and we went and lived with my grandma for a while. And she had her house was her parents' house. So it was an old house. And then it was like, they had a beautiful little library in there and just books and stuff. And I just remember sitting in there and reading those books, and it had like a magical feeling and stuff like that, being in their special library, you know. And they had like plastic runners, so you walked on the plastic runners, you didn't walk on the carpet like that. So anyway, so I think maybe that's where it was rooted, but I definitely think it's, to me, it's just the idea of art and like and things will, if you don't make space for new things, you lose a lot. So I think, and you lose a lot of voices too. Like that's the one thing that I love about the indie lit community is there are like kind of homogenized groups, but overall it's super diverse, like people all over the place. And I mean that racially and religiously and all those types of ways, but I also mean like there are super poor people who are writing in their between their three jobs and producing really cool, amazing work that they'd be hard for them to have a space. Anyway, we all know all these things, but I just think that's the coolest thing about indie lit. And I think, again, like we need to put the art back in literature and at least have a space for it. I don't want to make it like an us versus them type of thing, because I really don't feel that way. I like popular books too, but there's just way more space for them. So
yeah, I actually feel the same way. I mean, that's something I try to resist, like working within this space is just like not getting bitter or angry about the things that people are consuming on a
right.
large scale, because like you said, I like that stuff too. Like I just watched Pieces of Her on Netflix and I was like, this is a really good show, like right. You know,
speaking of popular things, I just watched the Andy Warhol Diaries on Netflix, and it's just funny because we're all the same, we do the same things over and over and over again across millennia, but like it's just funny to watch all of that little group that he was with like catfight with each other and be like, can you believe, you know, Basquiat has this show and why don't I have this show, and you know, like it's just funny because it's like you guys are all, well at that point they were all billionaires, so just chill out type of thing. But
yeah,
everyone's always got like, and it can be super demoralizing to think about the disparity in compensation.
Yeah, for sure.
It's real. But yeah, I mean, it's just kind of like, to me, it's just the sad reality. I'm not like a business person. Like I don't have a good mind for how to do that. So it's like someone smarter than me has to figure out how we can make more money doing this. But
totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah, one of the first conversations that I had for the show was with the writer named Seb Dubinsky. He was telling me about like a friend of his who was getting upset that like so many calls for submission didn't fit the guidelines that he could adhere to. Mm-hmm. And he was saying like his friend was saying like, I'm getting forced out of this, and he said to me, well, but actually that's like a trick, because you know, the trick is to like make us think that there's only so many seats and we all have mm-hmm. to fight over the seat. But the reality is like, we can all have a seat, and like, that's the, you know, that's the secret. And yeah. I just thought that was such a cool idea. I've just tried to live by that ever since.
I like it a lot. I think too, at least for writers, the frustration with writing is that it's fucking slow. It is so slow. It takes people a long time to read. You could submit something. And like, I think about, I've had everything that I've ever written almost, I'd say like 93% of everything I've written has been published, but it has taken some pieces years and years and years and years and years. So I think like that's the frustrating thing for writers in particular, is that it's a slow, slow, God, painfully slow process.
Yeah.
But I agree. I think if you have faith in it and you like it, you should just keep trying. And some things you, I think for younger writers, at least you will be thankful that it didn't get published. You know what I mean? Like yes. Some earlier you'll be like, thank God, because this is embarrassing.
Totally. Yeah. I'm just starting to publish a little bit now. And you know, when I was younger, when I was like in my early 20s, I was so desperate to publish. And so like I would have, you know, anywhere that would have published me, right. I would have been happy. But now I'm like, oh, thank God I didn't publish some of that stuff. You
know? And then it's floating on the internet when people Google your name, you're like, God, yes. Damn it. Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Even some people that I've talked to for the show, you know, I'll bring up something that they wrote maybe like 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And you know, they're like, oh yeah, I don't like that one as much anymore. You know? Right. And which maybe that's good, you know, cause we're always changing and you know, hopefully getting better and exploring new stuff in work. But yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that can be kind of like a curse. I heard somebody say that recently, that it can be kind of a curse to get like success very young. So
yeah, I think that makes sense for sure, or at least for me, because I was an idiot.
Totally, me too. So Small Fair is going on.
Yeah,
is it the end of this week?
Yeah, it starts on Friday night with a what's the date, the 19th or 18th? 18th. Mm-hmm. With a keynote from Brian Evanson, which is really exciting. And then we're running through the 26th.
Nice. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about just for listeners what it is and like how it got started?
Sure. So right when COVID was hitting, I was just on Twitter scrolling through, and someone, Annalise Gelman wrote just a tweet saying, like, kind of being like, oh man, like a lot of the book fairs that were switching to online charged a fee, and it was hard for a lot of people because they're like, oh, I'm not like going. And so anyway, you know, just the financial burden basically. So I was like, someone should do a free one. I was like, oh yeah, let's do it. So it really started out of COVID necessity, but the idea was that we'd provide a space, a free space for presses to participate. And then someone had the idea to have an events calendar. So there's kind of, we're hosting the readings across the different presses. So there's 12 of them. That's on Saturday night. And then also the keynote, obviously. But other than that, we don't host the readings, but you can add your events there. We do giveaways. We have hundreds and hundreds of giveaways to give away. So join our mailing list or follow us on social. It's just a space to like, I really didn't want to like do any gatekeeping. Like maybe just as a perpetually uncool person, like I've applied to things and, you know, you just feel bad about yourself and you're like, I guess I'm not cool enough or whatever. So I was like, I don't want to do that. So the only stipulation was that people had to have had at least one published book or issue of their journal. And so that was it. And the first year we had, you know, over 100, and this year we have 260 plus. So I think 261 or 262 tables, and it's going to be great. Everyone's giving discounts and stuff. Like I have my budget personally, and I'm just going to go through the tables and try and stick to my budget. It's going to be great. And just dozens and dozens of events. It's super cool. Yeah.
Yeah. It's when I was looking at the website, it kind of seemed like a cool online kind of like DIY AWP.
Yeah. Yeah, it was hopefully to, you know, provide a space for people who couldn't necessarily afford to AWP or to go to AWP. Like, that's been one of the coolest things is that, well, first that it makes space for poor people because we like books too. And then two, that people from all over the world can go, you know, like you're meeting people from South America and parts of Asia and stuff and South Africa and stuff. Like, so it's just cool. You're like, oh, I like, we would never talk probably otherwise. So anyway, yeah, it's super cool. And it's all been volunteer run and it's a ton of work, but it's always a good time. So
yeah, no, that sounds fantastic. And I love that aspect of, you know, the indie lit, the online literature scene is just the way that people are able to connect across state lines and even countries and over this thing that, you know, that they share.
Yeah. And I think too, one of the cool things is like, we all are the same, even if we're completely different. Like there's super genre fiction in there. There's like horror and romance, and there's people who only publish, you know, queer poets or you know, disabled writers, blah, 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 blah. Like they all have their niche, but we're all doing the same thing. So it's cool to see both our commonality, but also the incredible variety in what's out there right now. Because people, again, feel like, oh, I'm getting pushed out of places or I don't have a place to submit my work to. And it's like, look at all these places.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. So. I mean, I felt that way even looking at the website and seeing all of the different, you know, presses and magazines that are participating and just, I don't know, I guess you kind of forget like how much is out there, but
yeah,
seeing so many that I was familiar with, I was like, wow, there's so much good stuff being put out all the time.
Even people you love, you're like, oh, right. These yeah. people are so freaking cool. I forgot about them. Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah. Yeah, there's just, I wish I've tweeted this once. I wish I could like buy more time to add to my life just so that I could read books right. people right. that I know and stuff. Well, one of the last things I wanted to ask you was about kind of like all of this stuff. Like, I think, you know, there's a lot of people who are looking at the online literature community and just reading their friends' work and wanting to do something like start a press or start a magazine. Oh, yeah. And you know, something I've realized with the podcast is that there's all these skills that I had to learn about, like, I mean, I'm still kind of learning them about, like, you know, promotion and
yeah,
design and things like that. And I was just wondering if you had any advice or if there's anything that you would have liked to know starting out kind of participating in some of these things for someone who might want to.
Sure. So that for like a press. So if just for a writer, I guess I would say, especially a writer that doesn't have an MFA, like I don't have an MFA. So one of the biggest values of an MFA is the built-in community or a built-in little group that you know and stuff. And when you feel like you don't have that, I do think stuff like Small Fair, stuff like well, Entropy's gone now, but there are resources here and there that can help you really introduce to different things. Like Jason Teal's Heavy Feather is doing an amazing job, I think, like really bringing people together and showcasing resources and different work and stuff like that. And that, like, find those little things and grow from there, or like they one thing will always lead to another. But for people interested in presses, I worked professionally right out of college as an editor for a large nonprofit. So I had a little bit of that background, but I had no background in like book design or marketing or the legal aspects of it. So what can I say? So like, first of all, your aesthetic is your aesthetic. Like if you know it, then that's fine. You set up your website. There are a lot of tutorials on like how to set up books and stuff like that online. The things that I wish I had known are like you don't have to buy barcodes. There are a ton of things to make free barcodes on the internet and stuff like that, because they're very expensive. You do have to buy ISBN numbers. Make sure you know your sales tax law wherever you're from and all that, those little things that you're like, oh shit, like I had no idea about. But other than that, I do think too, like, try and make friends with other publishers. I think in general, I mean, some people are grumpy, that's true anywhere, but most people would at least point you in the right direction and stuff. Like, just try reaching out to people you admire, I would say, that aren't big. Like, I don't want to name any names, but like big in the indie community, I'd reach out to smaller in the indie. They're more likely to help you. But I think in general, it's probably true. I know I would if people sent me an email. I mean, I don't know if I'd like sit down and walk you through all the steps, but I definitely would say, oh, here's this that I use and here's this that I use type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's been the case for me too. Just people going, hey, have you checked this out? And blah, blah, blah. And marketing, just like you're saying, marketing is the hardest part, I feel like, in a lot of ways. Like, it's not a skill that comes naturally to me, I don't feel. And so if you can get a team, that'd be great, with people that have very differing skills. And that's why I think partly that Small has been so successful, is that Turnpunked, we have readers, but beyond that, it's really a one woman show. Small has like a group of volunteers, and they all have different strengths. And I think that's what really makes it successful, because where I have no strength, other people have that, you know, so if possible. But yeah, I guess that's any good team, I suppose.
Yeah, that is a really good piece of advice, kind of having a team of people or you know, people that you work with who have skills that you might not have, like, because I guess some people can like do everything, can like design, can promote, can, you know, edit, but I feel like,
right,
you know, if you have the opportunity or the ability to work with other people, that could be really beneficial, because like I'm learning a little bit of design right now, and it's a totally different way than my brain works, so it's super challenging. Yeah, I think that's really good advice.
Yeah. And the only other thing I would say, at least what I do, is take on too much. So it's like, limit, at least for your first few years, while you're figuring it out, like, do 2 or 3 titles. Like, you don't have to do 6 or 7, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what I would tell myself if I could go back.
Yeah. Yeah, I would imagine it is hard when you're starting out. You want to, like, because it's exciting and you want to, you know.
Right. And there's a lot of cool stuff out there. Yeah. Yeah.
But I could imagine that, you know, taking on too much, you could get burnt out.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's why you see so many come and go. It's also kind of a thankless job, you know, like, it, at least for me, I think of it very much like a volunteer thing. Kernpunk makes money enough to, you know, keep going. I'm not compensating myself with Kernpunk and stuff. So it's, again, kind of like I think of it as like a literary citizenship. Like, I'm providing good karma, I guess, and an like a platform for people to kind of springboard off of. And
yeah,
but like, be realistic, like, most people, I don't know, maybe I'm doing something wrong, but I don't think you're gonna make money. So just be prepared, it's gonna be just for the love of it, basically.
Totally. Yeah. I mean and that's kind of what I meant too about, you know, how I can tell that a lot of people who are doing what you're doing have a lot of love for it, because I think it must, yeah, I've kind of assumed that it must be a thankless job, you know, and that, I've sort of seen the way people can, you know, treat, you know, members of the community that are, you know, running presses or magazines, and just the way people can kind of like ask for things without adding in any kind of introduction, like, hi, you know, hi, I'm, you know, nice to meet you, thank you for what you're doing. Sometimes I've seen it sort of just be like, hey, can you do this for me? And
right,
I don't know, I mean, that always feels a little strange.
I also think too, people don't realize how much, like, everything is money. So when you have like this much money to spend on it, and people are like, oh, well, when you see like different prizes and stuff, all those prizes cost like so much money just to enter, you know what I mean? And then you have to send 15 books off to different people and stuff like that. It's like, it's cool when people get recognized, and they should 100% be recognized. And I'm not saying the people on the prize committee shouldn't be compensated, but I'm just saying it can make it hard. Like, yeah. For so, yeah, I mean, money, it sucks. I
totally,
I wish there was more of it,
but yeah,
yeah.
Well, on a more fun topic, are you working on anything right now?
Yeah, I'm trying to wrap up a novel. It's like, I was trying to do like kind of a folk horror novel. It's set around where I live in upstate New York and based on like a local legend around here. And then I'm thinking, trying to do another play because people responded so nicely to it. But
yeah,
yeah, that's what I'm. And I also have a chapbook coming out this year from Dancing Girl Press about real historical women. It's just poetry about different historical women. Yeah.
Nice. No, that all sounds awesome. And I'll put links to everything in the episode description so everyone can go find it. Cool. Is there anything in particular, whether it be with your press or the playwriting or your fiction, that you want people to keep an eye out for?
Yes, thank you. So the titles coming out from Kernpunkt are, we just published Jared Joseph's A Book About Myself Called Hell. It's like a pseudo spark notes about Dante's Inferno, but from the perspective of someone living through COVID. So it sounds not pleasant, but it's hilarious. So yeah. It's surprisingly funny. C.A. Valencios, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, is he just did The Smoke Is Me Burning. It's a Southern Gothic novel about two brothers and like intergenerational trauma. And his writing is really, really beautiful and lyrical. And he's from Greece. So he don't know how he got captured, you know, Arkansas so well. This summer, next is William Lessard's An Instrument for Distributed Empathy or Empathy Distribution. It's our first poetry chapbook. It's all about art in, you know, production under capitalism. And it's really interesting. He does really cool, like hybrid type work with patents and makes poetry out of like these business documents. It's really cool.
Nice.
Unearthingly from Julia Mithra is coming out in July. And that's like a collaged, imagined primary sources all put together, telling a story about a tomboy in Colorado in the early 1900s. And last is Deborah de Blasi's Birth of Eros. So Deborah de Blasi is really cool, and it's a feminist kind of revenge story. And it's told in vignettes. That's beautiful. Yeah. The only other thing I'd say, just to not just talk about Kernpunkt, is I've written a ton of book reviews lately. So I'll just plug, we've published his a previous book of his, but Andy Farkas has a really great book out. I think it's the University of Nebraska Press. But it's called The Great Indoorsman. And it was really, it's creative nonfiction. And it's just really hilarious and smart. And I just did a review for Viki Now's Waiting for God, which was a play put out by Apocalypse Party. And it's really smart and super bizarre in the best way. Like I love her so much. I think she's one of the smartest, I think she's one of the best writers of living right now. It's so cool. Yeah, just wanted to shout, there's so many people doing cool things. Like, it's hard to fit them all in those, but those are the ones that are popping to mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I Waiting for God, I've wanted to read that. So I'm glad to hear the recommendation.
Yeah, it's cool. Are you big into Beckett or anything with Waiting for Godot or anything?
You know what? I've never, no, but my boss is actually obsessed with it and has a poster of it in our office. So I think I've been feeling like I'm supposed to check it out because it keeps showing up.
Yeah. I have the play and stuff. I think I would suggest like if it were me, there are a ton online of, you know, just on YouTube of different performances and stuff. Like the last one I watched, I don't know if this is, you know, fancy enough for people, but Robin Williams was one of them and stuff. I just thought that was like really a good job. That's one I like particular. I don't, not that you have to read it to read or watch it to read Now's book, but yeah, it does. It's interesting. Like the juxtaposition is really interesting because it definitely comes from it, but it's definitely its own beast.
Nice. Yeah. I didn't realize that there were like multiple adaptions. So that's really cool. That's, yeah. I love stuff like that. Like I've probably like the most, you know, truly nerdy thing about me is I really love Shakespeare and I love watching different like Shakespeare films, like cool. All the different Hamlets and Macbeths and stuff. So I always like seeing different ways people interpret plays and things like that.
Have you seen the new one, the Coen brothers?
No, I really want to see it.
It's gorgeous. I mean, just aesthetically, it's so pretty. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I follow it very well. You'll probably follow it better.
Oh, for sure. it looks gorgeous. I think I want to go see it in a theater. So I've been trying to figure out, you know, when to do that. Yeah. But yeah, I do want to. So last question. What's something that, I guess you already kind of gave one, but what's something that you read recently that you really liked and a movie that you watched that you really liked?
Oh my goodness. Well, I can tell you the movie right away. I just watched Nitram, which is Nitram. It's about a kid who goes on a killing spree in Australia. I guess it was one of their biggest mass shootings. And the guy that plays the main character, it's super disturbing, obviously. And, but it was amazing. Like just his performance was incredible. I would highly recommend that. And then, I wrote down, cause I thought you were going to ask this. So I wanted to make sure I had my little list ready. So, I talked about Vicky now, who I just love everything that she's done. But I wanted to mention too, First Breaths from Oomph Press. And it's by an author named, okay, I got to try to pronounce his name. It's Mohammed Khair Eddin. There's a guy, I think his name is Jake like Sacer or something. He does like all these translations of this author's work. And he is incredible. Like, just incredible. So this is First Breath, but there's another one that's more of a novel that just came out from, I think like Lavender. Oh gosh, I forget the name of the press, but anyway, Khair Eddin, Khair Eddine. He's incredible, incredible. I did recommend both his poetry, this poetry book, which like blew my head off my body, and then the novel as well. Yeah.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. It was really wonderful getting to meet you and talk to you about your work and all the projects that you're working on.
Cool. I really appreciate the opportunity. And then the time we've been talking, I've seen your window go from black to sun. You woke up in the middle of the night. So I appreciated it.